and welcome to Lecture 13. I hope you are all enjoying this series and the topics that we are exploring. Please feel free to ask any questions that you might have about parenting and behavior management of children with special needs by calling in and leaving a recording of your question. I'll be happy to address them in the order that they arrive to me. Just to recap, here is the list of the 12 lectures that we've done so far. First, we talked about what comes first, behavior or emotions. Then we discussed doctors' predictions. We introduced ignore negative behaviors and separate without comment. We answered questions about adolescents and preemies. We talked about staying organized and consistent, and we explored sibling rivalry in children who are typically developing and children with special needs. We also discussed children with ADHD and how their needs should be addressed. And during the last two lectures, we explored INB, SWC, and missions in greater detail using adapted versions of the Are Your Hands Full audiobook, Volume 1. And today's lecture will introduce the six-week foundation. The 6 weeks, or more weeks in the case of children with special needs, is laden with many deep concepts in chinuch, most of which can be applied to children with special needs on various levels. During previous lectures, we introduced foundational strategies that teach children the yesod of behavior, and that is the ability to tolerate frustration and understand that life doesn't have to deliver to them what they want, when they want, and how they want it. The three key strategies for this phase, which takes at least 6 weeks for the child who is developing normally and will therefore take at least that amount of time for children with special needs, are ignore negative behavior, INB, separate without comment, SWC, and statement of missions. The purpose of INB, ignore negative behaviors, is that a child learns to tolerate frustration and regulate himself, as opposed to you regulating him or her. The purpose of SWC, separate without comment, is that the child learns to dissociate from a negative behavior without the reinforcing factor of your verbal directive, because language is quite a potent reinforcer. And missions, that's the strategy that wins the award, because the benefits of missions are simply amazing. Missions, as we spoke about last time, have two major benefits. The first benefit is that when you state a mission, such as the shoes belong in the closet, and the child does not put the shoes in the closet for various reasons, one of which is that he's not up to obedience, not holding by obedience, because he has not yet learned to tolerate frustration, then nothing bad happened because, after all, you never told him directly to put the shoes in the closet. So you've avoided a scenario of disobedience that won't need to be undone. The more scenarios of disobedience you avoid, the less of a disobeyer your child will become, and the more easily your child will transition over to obedience when you arrive to phase two of this program, whose main goal is obedience. The second major benefit of missions is the fact that the format of a mission makes your child think more and figure things out. The mission creates a problem solver. Like this. When you say, put the shoes in the closet, the child's brain simply has to process the language inherent in that command. As long as the language processing system in the temporal lobe is functioning, the child, if obedient, will simply put the shoes in the closet. However, if you say, the shoes belong in the closet, think of all the extra cognitive steps a child has to employ to translate your mission statement into the intended directive. Wow, what does a child have to think? The child has to think as follows. Number one, the meaning of the words, the shoes belong in the closet. Number two, the implication of the words. So what? So they belong in the closet. How are the shoes supposed to get to the closet? Why would my mother be telling me, of all people, that the shoes belong in the closet? 3, it must be, that the implication applies to me, and I've got to do something about this. This helps a child take responsibility for what's going on in the environment. 4, and then the child has to figure out what to do. He or she has to translate the information that has already entered the brain and turned it into an action. Wow, that's a lot of mental exercise. Now, imagine that instead of giving 25 commands per day, you gave 25 mission statements. Think of how much extra cognitive work your child's brain goes through just in order to follow these simple missions. What a lucky child. So just to review, the benefits of mission statements are: 1, you avoid all scenarios of disobedience so that your child doesn't continue the bad habits of disobedience while you're preparing to arrive at phase 2. During phase 2, you will teach your child to obey because, after all, as a frum yid in our society, one must be able to obey. And 2, you've really put your child's brain on the treadmill from the earliest time they understand language, so that besides simply processing what you said, they will be able to infer what your intentions are from your missions. This is a huge way to boost cognition. So phase 1 has so many benefits. 1, it teaches your child to manage frustration. 2, it distances your child from disobedience to make the transition into obedience easier. And 3, it increases your child's cognitive exercise every time you state a mission. So you're thinking to yourself, how will frustration tolerance, which is benefit 1, help my child obey? What does one thing have to do with the other? Well, I'll tell you. Let me ask you, what is obedience? Obedience is when I do something that I don't particularly want to do because someone else asked me to. Obedience is not that I do something because somebody promised me something good or threatened me with something not so good. Bribing or threatening is simply a setup where the adult managed to manipulate the environment so that the child wants to do what they're supposed to do. It does not possess any investment toward the future ability of this child to conform to the obedience requirements of our frum world. The child who has been threatened or bribed is simply doing what he was told to do for an ulterior motive. Either he does not want the subject of the threat, or he does want the subject of the bribe. Either way, he's not learning just to do the right thing for right thing's sake. What a shame, and what a waste of the 7,000 days that we get to raise these children. I often refer to this as the Chinese auction mentality. When organizations who are collecting money for their causes promise us prizes, offer us kitchens, trips to Eretz Yisrael, shaitels, etc., it's because they understand that a lot of us have lost touch with the idea of doing the right thing, giving the tzedakah, just because it's the right thing to do. We somehow need incentives and motivations that appeal to us in order for us to get ourselves to give tzedakah or do anything else that's right. I know this is a deep thought and maybe not so pleasant, and you probably might be thinking about all the Mika Amcha Yisrael Yidin who do so much good in Klal Yisrael. I know they're there. I see them. And they're literally holding up Klal Yisrael. But on the other hand, think of how many children we are raising who will not obey unless there's something in it for them. The mission statement of phase 1 and eventually the command of phase 2 work it out that the child arrives to obedience without being dependent on bribes or threats. That's a pretty wonderful predictor of your child's ability to become a contributor to Klal Yisrael without needing something in return. Now, here is a tidbit from the Hands Full audiobook, which will review some of the underlying concepts of Phase 1 and put things in perspective with a fun story, which is not true and is simply a figment of my imagination.
Phase 1 must last for at least 6 weeks. Why is this so? Appliances specifically operate with carefully timed cycles. A cake would not bake well in an oven that was not preheated, and dishes would not become clean without a pre-wash rinse in the dishwasher. Children need time to absorb their parents' messages and to adapt their behaviors accordingly. The 6-week foundation period is analogous to the preheat process in the oven and the pre-wash cycle in the dishwasher. Negative behaviors that are frozen solid are very difficult to cut away. Any attempts to remove such behaviors would require forceful and negative techniques. Therefore, it is crucial to allow behaviors to defrost and soften a bit so that they can be melted with gentle techniques. 6 weeks is 40 days. Rav Elimelech from Lezhensk stated that the minimum amount of time that it takes to change Amida is 40 days. This is found in Settle Cotton, which translates into approximately 6 weeks. This correlates with our 6-week foundation, which we need to build before we can expect to see changes in behavior. It is common for parents to become frustrated when they are asked to implement INB or SWC repeatedly over and over again without seeing immediate results. They can't help but wonder, how long will this take? How many times will I have to do this before the lesson is finally learned? Rav Preda demonstrates the answer to this question in Erevin, Daf Nun Dalid, Amud Beis, by teaching lessons 400 times to a student who was experiencing difficulty. Most likely, parents will not need to separate a child from any single behavior anywhere near 400 times before the lesson is learned. Are you daunted by the thought of standing up, approaching a child, and physically separating that child without speaking to him or her? Remember that this process is not forever. Most of separate without comment occurs during the first 6 to 8 weeks of this program. During this period, negative behaviors are given the opportunity to die of neglect, which is the most effective way to eliminate them without damaging the parent-child relationship through the transmission of negativity. Although SWC is always available to use throughout the first decade of child rearing, the difficult process of withholding verbal commands and replacing them with SWC admissions usually doesn't last more than 2 months. To illustrate this point, consider the following true scenario, which I have encountered hundreds of times when parents come to me for direction to parent a difficult child. When they arrive to the first session, they half-jokingly ask me to recommend an adoption agency since they are absolutely sure that they cannot tolerate their child's behavior for 1 minute longer. Since arranging adoptions is not my profession, I introduce phase one of the behavior modification program to them. Slowly, as child and parents progress, we move on to phase two and then phase three. At the beginning of phase three, I usually ask the parents to give me a list of behaviors in which the child is still involved so that we can work toward eliminating them. Amazingly, during this session, the parents are invariably unable to come up with even one behavior. At this point, I usually jokingly ask them if they are still interested in an adoption agency. This scenario occurs because of the implementation of INB and SWC during phase one. During this phase, the behaviors that were previously so upsetting to parents die of neglect, and ultimately, there are usually none left to list for phase three. The following story is entirely fictional. After watching her husband light the 8th candle of the menorah, Mrs. A's thoughts drifted toward Purim. Always one to be organized and efficient, she began thinking about different theme ideas. By the next morning, Mrs. A had it all planned. She would make mini kokosh cakes for Mishloach Manos and present them in a dark brown wicker basket together with a container of chocolate milk and an elegant bar of chocolate. Everyone loves chocolate, and this Mishloach Manos was going to be a chocoholic's delight. As Tu B'Shvat neared, Mrs. A decided that it was time to start baking batches of kakash cakes to freeze them for her Mishloach Manos. She calculated that if she made one batch per week, she would have ample time to complete all of them in time for Purim. However, on the last week of her schedule, which was the week before Purim, there was a setback. Maishi was home for 5 days with a stomach virus, and Mrs. A could not manage to bake that week's batch. Though it pushed her off schedule a bit, she still had one morning available for baking the following week, Tanis Esther morning. She made sure to have all the ingredients in the house the night before, and as soon as she had sent the children to school, she began putting up the final batch of dough. But things did not go as smoothly as she would have liked, and by 12:30, when the first of her children started coming home from school, she was still rolling out the dough and sprinkling on the cocoa. Under intense pressure to finish the batch, Mrs. A gave Maishi a fleeting smile and went back to work. "You want to see my Megillah, Ma?" he asked. "Not now, Maishi," Mrs. A said. "I need to make these kakash cakes." Maishi left the kitchen, but he was back every few minutes to check if she had finished. After the fifth visit, Mrs. A finally had enough and exploded. "Maishi, can you please leave me alone?" she yelled. "I will not be able to read your Megillah until I am finished. Do you hear me?" Resigned, Maishi went to the toy room and got busy with his Lego. Purim came and Purim went, and everyone all but forgot about Mrs. A's kakash cakes. Her children grew up, got married, and Mrs. A lived a nice, long, and happy life. After reaching the ripe old age of 120, Mrs. A left this world to face Hashem in the Olam HaEmes. Hashem took out the book of Mrs. A's life and began to review each incident, the way Mrs. A dealt with each nisayon that was sent her way. Somewhere in the middle, they reached the Tanis Esther afternoon where Mrs. A was making those kakash cakes. Hashem turned to Mrs. A and questioned, "What happened? Why did you scream at my Maishala?" Mrs. A was shaking as she responded, "But I was doing it for you, Hashem. I was making the Mishloach Manos for you." "For me?" Hashem responded. "You were making kakash cake for me?" "I made kakash cake for you. I made you Green's kakash cake. I made you Stern's kakash cake. I made you Zisha's kakash cake. You have kakash cake in loads of other bakeries. My kakash cake wasn't good enough for Mishloach Manos. It had to be yours. I didn't need your kakash cake. I needed you to have compassion for my Maishala." Hashem has made so many different kakash cakes for us, conveniences that make our lives easier. He made takeout food. He made washers, dryers, dishwashers, and microwaves. He made babysitters. He made cleaning ladies. There is so much at our disposal to help us cope with everyday stresses in order to avoid the intense, often self-imposed pressure that causes us to scream at the precious Yiddish neshamas that he so graciously put in our care. Hashem does not need our homemade challah and potato kugel. He would much rather that we spend quality time with our children and be able to pass on his beautiful Messiah in a calm and pleasant fashion.